Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Notable.
Hello and welcome to Notable.
Hello, I'm Elizabeth Holker.
I'm Stuart McConey. This is program two of what we are now going to call series two,
series
having received
two.
An irate letter.
It was a tweet.
Was it?
From an English listener, yeah, who doesn't like the Americanization of podcast terminology.
Okay, well... All right, then, at least for this programme, we're going to defer to that listener's wishes and call it this Series 2, and this is Programme 2, in which we, as we do in every Notable, we talk to each other and we tell each other about interesting, unusual, quirky, fascinating, thought-provoking stories from the entire history of music.
That's right, it is. I thought you were slipping into American accent then.
Really?
So we can use English terms, but... Maybe we'll start doing it in American accents.
Oh, no. Did I slip into a transatlantic delivery?
No, I think the connection was slow and it sounded like a southern drawl, but it was just a glitch with the internet.
Well, rest assured, Elizabeth and dear listeners, that I'm not slipping into a Simon Bates-style transatlantic delivery for this show. The second of the new series... Series one is all there. There's eight of them there. Who knows how many there'll be in this one? But thank you for your responses thus far, the very warm and kind responses that we've had. And you can get in touch with us at NotablePod.
Yep. And we're on Instagram as well, at NotablePod.
You need to tell them about Instagram. I'm not down with Instagram.
we tried to make you an influencer, Stuart, do you remember?
No.
At Hollingworth Lake. We posted a picture of you with an ice cream.
I did
and
recently.
And hoping to connect with the kids.
I did.
That sounds weird.
I did recently... post a load of pictures of me walking up the Bridgewater Canal from Wigan to Lee in an attempt to become a major Instagram influencer. But
I liked them all.
Well, anyway, if you want to like and you want to subscribe, we are available wherever you get your podcasts from. Sorry, that was a joke. that accent, yeah. What are we going to talk about today?
So today I'm going to talk about the song Scarborough Fair. And what have you got, Stuart?
And I'm going to talk in a moment about Stalin. And his influence on classical music. I know. The fun never stops here on Notable. I'm going to talk about Stalin, who has, for a complete non-musician, although apparently he was a rather good singer, for a politician rather than a musician, he had a very profound effect on Russian music in the 20th century, good and ill. So we'll come back to him in a moment. Scarborough Fair. Tell me about it.
Yes. So Scarborough Fair, this is a song. What is the version that everybody knows? It's the one by Simon and Garfunkel.
It is, yeah.
Everyone knows this song. Everyone knows the Simon and Garfunkel version. But actually, this is a story not just about that song, but about British folk music and the folk revival in the late 50s and 60s. And it all kind of goes back to this one person, Martin Carthy, who is now considered... a giant. I mean, he's totemic of the English folk revival, isn't he?
Yes.
You'd almost think he was, I don't know, chiselled out of a cow shed in Norfolk. But actually...
Wow. You could think that. He's one of the giants, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
Davy Graham, Bert Jansch, Richard Thompson, Martin Carthy. These are the big guys, aren't they?
Yeah. They are. He is. And, you know, Martin Carthy now is married to Norma Waterson, the Waterson-Carthy
dynasty.
Yeah, yeah, it's a folk family, isn't it? They are the establishment.
They're the first family of folk. The folk aristocracy. Folktrocracy, if you will.
But, yeah, so this cowshed in Norfolk, that's not where he came from. He actually grew up in East London.
Yeah.
He was inspired to take up the guitar, not because his parents were, you know, also... soaked in the folk tradition, not by a long way. I think his parents were musicians and music played at home, but he wasn't born into this folk dynasty. He actually was inspired to take up the guitar after he heard Lonnie Donegan.
Yeah.
So Skiffle, we know the story of Skiffle. We know that Skiffle kind of birthed rock and roll, but actually what's lesser known is that Skiffle was responsible in part for these, you know, giants of the folk movement as well, deciding to pick up guitars and play, because skiffle was folk music, essentially sped up, wasn't it? And
yeah, skiffle is folk music, really.
Yeah,
isn't
absolutely.
It? Sort of folk punk.
Yeah, folk exactly.
Folk punk, mainly about trains, isn't it?
So, Martin Carthy, he hears Lonnie Donegan, as many teenagers in the late 50s who heard Lonnie Donegan sing were inspired to do. He also picked up the guitar. And it wasn't until he was at his friend's house, his friend, I think he was called Chris Barker or something like that, his dad said, Lonnie Donegan is a fake. He's actually just picking up these folk songs and speeding them up. And that's what you're hearing. You know, he didn't write the songs.
Yeah.
This kind of piqued Martin Carthy's interest. And he realised that these songs had a story to them. So, I mean, he must have been such an inquisitive teenager in the 50s to think, oh, try and trace the roots of these kind of traditional songs.
There was a lot of it about, though, wasn't
there? There was, yes.
Like you Rolling Stones and people, it was really cool for amongst the cooler kids to be like, we're going to track down the original source music made by these poor black people rather than listen to the showbiz versions, you know?
Yeah, and what's it, like you say, you know, the Rolling Stones were tracing the roots of the blues, but Martin Carthy was doing it with English folk music. And that was something that was also kind of, you know, there was a lot of that around at the time. That was something that was more popular at that time as well. And we were talking a little bit about this in the Bob Dylan episode, weren't we, in series one? Just how there was this kind of appetite or a thirst for something that was a little bit more authentic at the time,
something that
was rootsy and that was, you know, back a bit more back to basics and, like I say, had this authenticity. To track these things down, you had to, it's a proper research job, isn't it? You couldn't just look it up online. So 17-year-old Martin Carthy, he started to go to Cecil Sharp House.
Yeah.
He tells a funny story about them sort of looking down their noses at him when he tried to go there as a teenager to look at the stuff that was in their library. Cecil Sharp House, if people don't know, it's a big folk archive centre venue, isn't it, in London.
He's a whole other podcast, Cecil Sharp.
It probably is.
But yes, he has a, there's a house named after him in London, which is a venue and which hosts an archive of British folk, isn't it?
Yeah. So it's funny to think that they were looking down their noses at Martin Carthy.
Yeah.
who would become the, what did you call it? Folktrocracy.
I think I kind of mangled it a bit first time. I said that no, he was folktocracy. Yeah.
So yeah, so here's Martin Carthy, 17-year-old, scouring London for signs of these British folk songs, where they might have come from. The Troubadour Club was where a lot of folkies were hanging around at that time.
Yeah.
He says he remembers the first time he walked down the steps, he heard bagpipes, which I think would put a lot of people off, but it made him want to go further.
Put me off. In a small basement club?
Yeah, small basement club. The Troubadour, it's in Earl's Court, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not an instrument designed for a small basement club, a bagpipe.
It's not really.
Sorry, any bagpipers out there, but it really isn't.
No, I don't mind it. I don't mind it at Edinburgh Castle.
I was going to say, it's best enjoyed al fresco.
Yeah, you know. It is. Not so much in a confined space. There was another club, Ballad and Blues. That was Ewan McCall's club. Apparently, Ewan McCall used to make people who performed there sing in their original accent, even though he was from Salford, but he sang in a Scottish accent.
That's right.
He had Scottish roots, but, you know. Yeah, so we have these. I think what's interesting is you get this weird kind of intersection of these original folkies and these old folkies, these people who've just been singing these songs for years and years and years, and no one have really paid much attention to them. People like Sam Lana. And then all these beatniks, young beatniks come along, these young kids and 60s people who were interested in the songs all of a sudden. And some of the older folkies started to see a little bit of a revival as well. So, yeah, so you've got this happening. I think also, like you were saying, the fact that these younger people wanted to go back and trace the roots. Lots of different versions of these songs as well. You know, there's a song, Pretty Ploughboy. I know it's a Norfolk song, but there are versions that are found all over the UK. That was common, wasn't it? And lyrics were appropriate for different places and times. Some melodies, there would be variations according to what day it was performed, or, you know, different singers would have their own different version as well. So it's a vast thing that Martin Carthy was interested in taking on.
We should say that he's also, I mean, he goes on to be in Steel Ice Band twice. And like you said, this is early on in the 60s, before Waters and Carthy, before Steel Ice Band. At this time, Martin Carthy comes up with his own very distinctive version, his arrangement of the old folks in Scarborough Fair.
He does, yeah. He's actually given the song by Ewan McCall. You know, he's got his own variation. And it became his song. So all these popular folk songs would be played on the folk scene, but certain folk artists would have one that was theirs. And Martin Carthy had a Scarborough Fair.
Because the thing he brings to it, which is what everybody knows, is the guitar figure, isn't it?
It is, really.
Distinctive bit of guitar picking. If you mention Scarborough Fair to people, it's that intro, and that is entirely Martin Carthy's. That's not an old folk tune. He brings that new arrangement, doesn't he? Yeah.
He does, yeah. And also, I think we were talking about, you know, this desire for something authentic, but also in the 60s, the English countryside, there was, you know, an association with psychedelia, wasn't there? And
yeah,
that idea of kind of escaping to a rural idyll and...
Yeah, but that guitar figure that he puts on that's entirely his own, that's quite psychedelic. That bit of picking in Scarborough Fair is quite psychedelic. So there's a nod to what is going to become happening in British pop as well, yeah.
Yeah. Obviously, what's going on here is often mirrored in the States, and this is the case at this time as well. As we were saying with the Dylan episode, a lot of Americans were also on the hunt for something a bit more authentic as well. And so it makes sense. Bob Dylan wouldn't just look for that in the States. He came to the UK. And he became really good friends with Martin Carthy for a short time. In fact, I've been to Martin Carthy's house in Robin Hood's Bay, and there's lots of pictures of him playing with Bob Dylan at the Troubadour.
Yeah,
they hung out for a little bit. The story goes that Dylan, he had the girlfriend, Susie Rotolo, who's on the front cover of Freewheeling Bob Dylan. She was Italian, and she went back to Italy, and he tried to go there to win her back, ended up staying in London, became friends with Martin Carthy. Martin Carthy played him Scarborough Fair, and Dylan took the you know, she was a true love of mine. The legend has it that at this time he was very heartbroken over Susie Rotolo, and that appears in his song Girl from the North Country.
It does, yeah.
Which is also inspired by Scarborough Fair. So that comes out in 63, and then 3 years later, we hear this version of Scarborough Fair by Simon and Garfunkel. Martin Carthy's not happy about this. Do you know about that?
Yeah, we should say, presumably Paul Simon's knocking around on the British folk scene and meets Martin Carthy, I guess, and hears his version, doesn't he?
Yeah, Martin Carthy isn't entirely sure how he ended up finding it exactly.
Because it's well known that Paul Simon did the British Folk Club, so I would have thought he would have bumped into Martin Carthy often.
Yeah, but, yeah, it's likely. Right. There were all kinds of rumours about these people as well, recording the songs in the clubs and then taking the demos back and like bootlegging them, basically.
Yeah.
Also, Paul Simon had signed away the rights to his publisher, so he wasn't earning any money from it. So when Paul Simon and, you know, Art Garfunkel's version was so popular, he didn't make the money out of that.
This is the interesting thing about it. He, for many years, Martin Carthy bore a real grudge, didn't he? Because we should say about how successful it becomes. It's on the Graduate soundtrack.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
It's a massive hit. But what it turns out is, if I've got this right, what it turns out is that Martin Carthy's publisher, unbeknown to Martin Carthy, had signed away all the rights to it, and he was getting the money.
He was, yeah.
We think. We're not entirely sure where all the money went. Certainly didn't go to Martin Carthy. Paul Simon signed the deal on the instruction that Martin Carthy got half of it, which never happened. But Paul Simon didn't get it either.
Yeah.
But it was this lingering open sore, really, for many years, wasn't it?
Yeah, that he overcame in the end. And they did perform it together on stage, Paul Simon and Martin Carthy, years and years later, and kind of healed that wound, I suppose, eventually.
Well, Martin Carthy said that he was tired of trudging through the grudge,
yeah,
and he decided he was going to let it go, didn't he? And then Paul Simon rang him up and said, "Are you mad with me?" And he said, "Yeah, I am. I've been mad all these years with this." And Paul Simon said, "Well, I've not made any money from this." And up till then, Martin Carthy thought that he did. And Martin Carthy said actually realising that provided him with a bit of closure. So at least he wasn't very angry and jealous with Paul Simon anymore, but angry with this unnamed music publisher. Because Martin Carthy, although Martin Carthy does know who it is, obviously, but that publisher is now dead. And Martin Carthy, I think, because he's a nice man, doesn't want to impugn the dead. So he very rarely brings the name up in interviews. But it turned out that neither of them made any money from it. And as Martin Carthy said, that song must have made millions.
Yeah.
Millions and millions in DVDs, in soundtracks, in adverts. It must have made millions, and neither he or Paul Simon seen it. But as you say, when Paul Simon played Hammersmith Apollo in 1998, he rang up Martin Carthy, didn't he, and said, "Let's sort of bury the hatchet live."
And they played it live together. Also, the Stone Roses did a version of it as well, didn't they? Elizabeth My Dear.
Well, they called it Elizabeth My Dear, didn't they? The Stone Roses version. They borrowed the tune. Sergio Mendes has done a you know, sort of bossa nova version of it. Yeah, it will have made a lot of money.
Yeah.
And we don't know who got it. Yeah.
I know.
To return to the song itself,
I think the only folk song I can think of that is as well known is Greensleeves, maybe.
That's interesting because it's quite a similar song, isn't
it? It is very similar and very evocative of the same kind of place and ideas, I suppose. You know, very sort of British and rural, isn't it?
Yes, and it has got that same modal British folk quality to it. And of course, Henry VIII, who is supposed to have written Greensleeves, but loads of people say he didn't. So the authorship of it is in question as well. So it's kind of similar to Scarborough Fair in that sense as well. There's been a long running, in inverted commas, legal disputes about the authorship of it as well. And I think you're right. From the contemporary folk tradition, the British folk revival of the 50s and 60s, no other song from that, I don't think, has entered the popular consciousness to the same degree. I mean, there are well-known ones like Pentangle's Light Flight and Davy Graham's Angie. Most people in the street may know the tune, but Scarborough Fair's a proper bona fide, like, massive global hit, isn't it?
Yeah. And so popular with children, isn't it? Everyone sings that at school. Both Greensleeves and Scarborough Fair are in the Dorian mode. So
interesting.
Yeah, maybe it's a catchy mode.
Interesting. And we should say that for our notable exception on this subject, one-off.
This is an unlikely collaboration between Paul Simon and not human beings, the Muppets. He appeared on the show many times, actually.
Yeah.
As did Elton John, Alice Cooper, Kenny Rogers, Diana Ross, Johnny Cash, Joan Baez. But it wasn't until 1980 that they decided to dedicate a whole episode of The Muppets to one artist alone, and it was Paul Simon.
It was indeed. He's the only artist to have a full Muppet Show special devoted to his music. And it begins with a sort of scene from Merry England at Scarborough Fair. It begins with that.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So, let me tell you about Stalin. Because he is a massively problematic figure. Back in the day, around about the time of the Second World War, people would have often said, oh, he was a great friend and hero to the Allied forces in the Second World War. There was even a hit record about him by the Golden Gate Quartet called Stalin Wasn't Stalin. It was a minor hit in the USA singing his praises. But as time's gone by, we've realised just what a, well, thoroughly nasty piece of work he was. You know, the list of crimes against humanity that he committed had become well known. But also, he was hugely influential on the musical culture of the Soviet Union. Stalin apparently, according to Will Self and Alex Ross, Will Self wrote a review of Alex Ross's book, The Rest Is Noise, about classical music. Apparently, Stalin had quite narrow musical taste, but quite good musical taste. He was a singer himself, and he apparently, as well as frequently attending the Bolshoi Ballet and concerts in Moscow, listened to classical music on the radio, and he audited every single classical recording that came out of Russia. More about that in a moment, because he has an influence on Russian music, a lot of it quite pernicious, but he sets up the Stalin Prize, 1941, 10 categories for an individual piece of music, top prize, 100,000 rubles, which apparently at the time would have bought you 6 automobiles. I'm not sure you could buy 6 automobiles in Russia at the time. But he was a patron, we might say generously, of the arts, as well as being hugely controlling of it as well. Just very quickly, you're going to mention 3 people whose music and musical careers he had a really profound influence on. Prokofiev. He was a prodigy. He was an absolute prodigy in the academy in Moscow. And he was allowed to leave his homeland after the Russian Revolution with the Soviet Union's official blessing, which was unusual. He went to America and then Germany, then Paris. He married a Spanish singer. But beginning around 1925, the Soviet Union and Stalin start to court him. They really start to want him back. Stalin wrote in his diary, "We really have to get Prokofiev back," because they were beginning to realise, I think, the Soviet regime, that they needed some of their homegrown talent, some celebrities, if you will, back in the Soviet Union to say, yeah, we like it here. The revolution's going fine. We love it. And to project a new, healthier image to the world. So they courted him and courted him and courted him. And he was homesick, as well, we should say. He'd had two kids who were both born in Paris. And I think he felt that he wanted to sort of reconnect with his homeland. So the Stalinist regime reached out to a few people. Rachmaninoff, who said no thanks. Stravinsky, who said no thanks. But Prokofiev says yes. He says that he will go back. And he made what he describes as a Faustian pact, if you like, because he knew that things were grim. He had friends in the Soviet Union who had been interrogated, had been arrested, had been tortured even for counter-revolutionary activities. He knew that he wasn't going back to a free society, but Stalin and the Stalinist regime promised him lucrative commissions, freedom of travel. They say he's going to have a nice apartment, a chauffeur, a good lifestyle. His work will always be performed. And he's just getting into middle age. He needs a bit of money. He needs a bit of regular work. And he thinks this sounds good. And for a while, it is. All that's absolutely fine.
Lieutenant Keiji was quite important, wasn't it, in that his film score. It was around that time that he wanted to come back from Paris, and that was a good way in, I think.
Yeah, and when he did come back, as I said, there was a honeymoon period when things did go well, but things kind of start to go wrong. A couple of his works that he produced, a couple of ballets that he produced, people start to say these are contrary to the spirit of the revolution. They start to censor his work a bit. And just generally, he starts to fall out of favour. Part of this is because the bureaucracy that controlled all composers' works.
Yeah.
Some people felt that he was getting ideas with his station. He was quite an arrogant man. And so they start to fall out of love with him in the Soviet Union. And so towards the end of his life, really, he ends up churning out what some people think is second-rate work, glorifying the regime and having his work heavily censored. But the ultimate irony of Prokofiev and Stalin's connection, Prokofiev dies on March the 5th, 1953, the same day as Stalin. And they die within hours of each other. But the astonishing thing is, they don't mention Prokofiev's death until Stalin's death's been announced. There were no funerals available for Prokofiev's funeral because all the funerals in Moscow had gone to Stalin. They couldn't even get his body out for 3 days from the Prokofiev apartment because the grief, the outpouring of grief, whether real or forced for Stalin's death, the streets are full of people. And they couldn't even get his coffin going to Novodevichy Cemetery. They couldn't even get that down the street because everyone's going in the opposite direction, going to Stalin's funeral. So he's overshadowed even in death, you know, by Stalin. The other main dude, I guess, who we think of, if I can call him main dude, Shostakovich's life is obviously, life and music is overshadowed by Stalin. Maybe the great modern, would you agree? Maybe the great modern Russian composer,
yeah,
Shostakovich?
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
15 symphonies, 15 string quartets, 6 concertos. I think maybe the symphonies and the string quartets are what he'll be best remembered for. He lived most of his life under this totalitarian regime. He never left, and he would fluctuate between being in favour and out of favour, which must have been so wearing, you know, for him. Must have been such a difficult way to live. He said the regime was unbelievably mean and hard. Every day brought more bad news, and I felt so much pain. I was lonely and afraid.
Also, the press would hammer their works, wouldn't they, as well? You know, it wasn't just that you were falling in and out of favour with the authorities or whatever. Well, you know, it was the establishment as well. The musical establishment would turn against you. And then the critics would pan your, you know, the premieres of your pieces, and it would be completely soul-destroying.
And who knows who those critics were? Because the famous incident, of course, is when he's 26, he makes this avant-garde opera called Lady Macbeth of the Matensk District, which is a huge success. But then in 1936, Stalin comes to see it with his apparatchiks in show. And the next day, there's an editorial in Pravda that says muddle instead of music and denounces the piece. And it's widely thought Stalin wrote that. And he said, things could end very badly for Shostakovich unless he switches musical gears and toes the line. And I think he does then produce another piece of work subtitled A Soviet Artist Replies to Just Criticism, because he was terrified. And then he switched and started to do what a good Soviet composer is supposed to do and back up the regime. And of course, there's the famous Leningrad Symphony. But underneath all this is terror. He's terrified. And if you want to get a good picture of that terror, there's a great book by Ian MacDonald called Testimony. And there's the Julian Barnes novel about Shostakovich's life, which show the fact that, you know, he kept a suitcase packed for his inevitable arrest. He slept on the stairwell for fear that the NKVD were going to come and find him.
Also, I think it was just incredibly soul-destroying as a creative as well, wasn't it? Because it was so kind of arbitrary what the regime required in some ways. You know, obviously they liked these big kind of bombastic pieces which made Russia seem strong and that might have been influenced by the folk music of Russia and, you know, which were nationalistic in their flavour and subjects, but also they frowned on any kind of experimentalism or independent thinking or spirit in the music, which is quite difficult to define, isn't it? So these composers, at a time when things elsewhere were, you know, branching out in all different directions, sound-wise and technique-wise and in terms of form and all that sort of thing, they were being sort of funneled in this really narrow and conservative direction, which must have been
so
frustrating. Well,
yeah, because there's this feeling that avant-garde music was bourgeois, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That it was a bourgeois indulgence to be avant-garde, and what you needed was songs that would inspire the workers, patriotic songs that would inspire the workers.
And that didn't allow for independent thought, really, or even, you know, a sonic expression of independence.
It's exactly what even Cornelis Cardew, who we should do a notable on, Cornelis Cardew, the British avant-garde composer, very left-wing composer, he, even in the 1960s and 70s, does the same thing. He starts off making this incredible avant-garde music and then renounces it because he says avant-garde music is bourgeois. Isn't the book he writes called Stockhausen Serves Totalitarianism, where he says all that avant-garde music is propping up capitalism. What we need are catchy tunes for the workers to sing, and he switches his musical style. And some of it's terrible, and some of it's quite good. These kind of pop songs he tries to write, these sort of left-wing pop songs.
There's another composer called Sofia Gubaidulina who was working in the 50s and 60s as well. And they had to smuggle her manuscripts out to get them premiered elsewhere in Europe, in Vienna and Paris. And she's one of the foremost composers of contemporary music from the Soviet regime. So
absolutely. Well, she's seen as that now, isn't she? But again, like everybody, like Shostakovich and Prokofiev and Shostakovich and Gubaidulina, they all struggled at the time. In 1953, as I said, Stalin dies, and you can almost feel the sense of relief in Shostakovich's music. He writes a dazzling piano concerto number 2 as a 19th birthday present for his son. And you can kind of hear in his later works that a burden's been lifted off him, and it's been full. It's full of energy and full of joy. And also the sarcasm and the wit that he'd been prevented from displaying as well. But here's an interesting last bit, and a composer that we may not know. Not a composer, but a musician we may not know. Maria Yudina, who is Stalin's favourite pianist, studied in the Petrograd Conservatory with Shostakovich, and a devout Christian, in absolute, you know, defiance of the state-imposed atheism. Shostakovich said she always played as if everything was a sermon. She would read the poetry of blacklisted writers during her performances. She wore a cross. She was sometimes banned, but Stalin loved her piano playing.
Yeah.
1944, he's listening to the radio, and he hears Yudina playing Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 23. He likes it so much, he immediately demands a copy of the performance. Of course, it's a live broadcast. There is no recording. No one dares tell Stalin this. And if you've seen the movie Death of Stalin, this incident is kind of is reenacted in the opening sequence with Paddy Considine. And so they have to get the musicians back together. They wake Yudina up in the middle of the night. They drive her to a studio. There's a conductor and a small orchestra. The conductor's so terrified he keeps screwing up. They change him for another. He can't handle it either. A third conductor is found. Yudina is remaining completely calm. At daybreak, at dawn, they've managed to record it. They press a single copy of it on vinyl and deliver it to Stalin, who doesn't know the difference, who can't tell the difference, which is absolutely amazing. And he then sends her 20,000 rubles, which is not bad. And she says, thank you very much. She sends him a letter back saying, thank you very much for your aid, and says, I will pray for you day and night and ask the Lord to forgive your great sins before the people and the country, which is an incredible thing to say to him. And, you know, he loved her music so much. Apparently, he read the letter and just put it away quietly, didn't say anything. 9 years later, after this event, on his deathbed, when people entered the room, when he did die, on the turntable was a recording of Yudina's that he'd been playing just before he died.
Wow, I didn't know that.
So you'd be tempted to say that the old terror did have a heart, but I mean, who cares? I mean, whatever his love of music, it doesn't excuse his crimes. But isn't that interesting that somewhere in that sort of black and old heart, there was enough of a love for music to let her criticise him like that? It's incredible. Or did he just admire her defiance? I don't know.
And so still to be able to enjoy the music, you know, that, like you say, that blackened heart, it still had an appreciation for this thing that is actually quite soulful and joyful. Yeah.
And if you don't know the music of the people we've been talking about just now, Goodbye Dalina, Prokofiev and Shostakovich, well, it goes without saying, have a listen to it. It's all good stuff.
Absolutely.
Well, that was Stalin. That was Scarborough Fair. We'll have another notable podcast for you very soon. In the meantime, we should say that if you want to come and see us do this thing live, we will be recording a live podcast in front of an audience at the Hinterlands Festival, won't we, Elizabeth?
We will. We're going on the road to Skipton for one night only. The 22nd of May, the Hinterlands Film Festival in Skipton. And you can get tickets at hinterlandsfestival.org.uk.
I think next week we're going to talk about two quite different subjects. Aren't we going to talk about a pioneer of electronica and when the world's best nightclub was in Wigan?
Yeah. Daphne Oram.
And Wigan Casino.
Mm.
Are the subjects of next week's Notable. Like us, subscribe us, get in touch with us at NotablePod or on that newfangled Instagram. See you next week.
Can you hear me all right? Can you hear me?
Notable, the podcast.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.